Hey, buddies, what's up? Godless Kinzer here, podcasting to you from LSA Anaconda near beautiful sunny Balad, Iraq. It's been another week, and you know what that means? It's time once again to hunker in the bunker for another episode of Watch It Burn. Watch It Burn is dedicated to the memory of Sergeant Brian Brewster and all of our brothers and sisters who have fallen. Rest now. Your work is done. On the 5th of May, a CH-47 helicopter crashed in Afghanistan. Sergeant Brian Brewster, who's 24 years old, died in that crash. He was a crew chief on that helicopter. He was in the 10th Mountain Division. He had gone there from Alpha Company, 7th of the 101st. I knew him. I worked with him. And I always enjoyed working with him. He was a good kid. He was a quick learner, a smart ass. Always had a joke ready about just about anything. Almost always in a great mood, and when he wasn't, he was so easy to cheer up. Just joke around a little bit, and he'd get joking back with you and cheer him right up. He'd only been married about 2 years, if I recall correctly, and he was just a lovable kid. Saw him come to our unit as a private. He was with us in Afghanistan, and the first time we were over here in Iraq, and he left as a sergeant, and it's just a sad, just pointless loss of life. This guy had his whole life ahead of him. I don't know what else to say, just that he's gonna be missed. I never hung out with him or anything like that, but I always looked forward to working with him. And it's just, I don't know what else to say.
They told us we'd be welcomed as troops of liberation. Once again they lied. We got shot at every day. Everywhere we went, a bunch of my buddies died. A rocket launcher hit my tank, started up a fire, blew my legs right off of me. Now you're looking at the face of victory. You're looking at the face of victory.
I've been working a lot this week, so I didn't really have anything prepared to do the show, so here's just me kind of freeform rambling, and you'll get to hear just how widely I digress sometimes. I don't really have a lot of material for tonight, folks, for this week's show, because I've been kind of busy at work and sleeping when I'm off work, so I don't have a lot of, haven't really worked up a lot of stuff to do here on the show. But I do have to say, I saw Stephen Colbert's appearance at, was at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and I have to say that was just, it was hilarious. It was brilliant, very well put together, and really keeping in the old tradition of the court jester, speaking truth to power in the form of jokes, so that it makes it a little more palatable. But you can see, if you watch the cutaway camera that was on the president, he wasn't too pleased, really, with what Colbert was saying, which is can be a good thing, because it kind of shows that he was right on the mark with so much of it. Especially that he called the media to task for not being aggressive enough in their defense of democracy by informing the public of what's really been going on. So the media fulfills, well, it doesn't really fulfill it anymore, but the media has a duty in a democracy to the people. Because a democracy only functions when the electorate is well-informed and can make informed decisions based on the knowledge that they receive from the media. In fact, the media is so important that it's the only industry in America that is mentioned in the Constitution. It is the only industry that is given specific protection in the Bill of Rights. And Jefferson and Madison really understood the importance of an educated electorate, because they knew that if people don't know what's going on, they can't make the right choices. And I guess I'm getting kind of redundant, but it's as simple as that. If the media doesn't tell you all of the facts, they can manipulate how you vote. And we saw a lot of that in 2004. A lot of stuff that was not published or not printed that was negative, or that could be perceived as negative because it was basically pointing out flaws in the administration's policies. It just was not heard in the mainstream media. Even as far back as the 2000 presidential campaigns, when you do LexisNexis searches on various topics and the two major candidates, you see a lot of positive stories about George Bush's proposals and a lot of negative stories, more negative stories than positive stories, about Al Gore's positions and proposals. And yet it was the reverse for George Bush, a lot more positive coverage than negative coverage. I think the mix works out something like 3-1 positive to negative for Bush, and 3 times as much positive for Bush as for Gore. God damn it. Noisy neighbors. Well, let's bear right on through this and see what happens. We'll wait a second here until they get out of the way. I actually want to pause this and drink my soup. Alright, the noisy neighbor is gone now, so let's resume this. Where was I at? Oh yeah. Okay. The supposedly liberal media. Just watch it for yourself and listen to the way things are reported. Listen to the way the commentators and the supposed newsreaders and anchors, the way they describe the events or the persons that are talking about. Listen for the descriptors, the adjectives, listen to the adjectives and the adverbs they use to describe the various personalities and issues in the daily news. And you'll see that it's fairly easy to spot bias in them and what their bias happens to be. Especially on Fox News, listen to when they're interviewing somebody who happens to be more progressive or liberal or is a Democrat, and listen to where the host chuckles, or where they seem a little sarcastic or a little snippy, and you'll notice that they are, by and large, very, very biased against the progressive side of it. They tend to be more the reactionary right-wing goose-stepper types. And same with CNN, especially like Wolf Blitzer. Listen to Wolf Blitzer and listen to the questions that he asks and listen to the way he asks the questions and the wording of the questions themselves, and you'll see how he attempts to lead viewers into a more right-wing approach to things. He's really, really obvious with his. It's crazy. And read newspapers. Read newspapers and then watch your nightly news and see how different the coverage is, and see what from the newspaper you found to be a fairly important, fairly life-affecting issue or event, and how little coverage it gets in the mainstream media, especially on network television news. And you'll notice that even in newspapers it happens to the extent where you won't see the important stuff on the front page. If you want to find the important stuff, start looking from like page 3 or so back, and that's where you'll start finding the important stuff. Look in the really small, usually you'll have a section where they'll have just little bits of news, like maybe 2 or 3 paragraphs, you know, 2 or 3 column inches, and that's where you'll find a lot of the really important stuff. Will just be just a mention, you know, like in today's Stars and Stripes, for example. If I have a copy of it right here, and there's just a little thing here. It's only about 1.5 column inches, and it says Bush vows to veto further spending. And that's the headline. So you think, okay, you know, he's talking about vetoing, you know, wasteful spending or something, the way that some people might interpret that. Except that he's never vetoed anything yet. And when you read what he has vowed to threaten to veto, it's kind of telling. It's President Bush on Friday renewed his threat to veto any war and hurricane spending bill that exceeds his request, and urged Congress to finalize an agreement to extend tax cuts. Okay, now what you got to realize that now, you think about that, is basically he is saying we're only going to spend this much on hurricane spending and war spending, but the hurricane spending, we're only going to spend this much, and I'm not going to let Congress be any more generous than that. not going to let Congress decide that, hey, what I said we're going to spend is not enough, and so I'm going to veto it if they try to spend more to help people that have been hit by hurricanes. And the whole thing, he keeps trying to extend and make permanent the tax cuts that he has had put in place. Now, these tax cuts, if you do the math, do a little bit of research, look at the Congressional Budget Office's reports, the General Accountability Office, or is it Accounting Office? Anyway, the Department of the Treasury statistics, IRS's own statistics, and you'll see that more than half of the tax cuts that he put in place go to people who make over $150,000 a year in the U.S. And you might think, okay, $150,000, that's, you know, mid to high level executive salary. And you think, okay, that's a lot of people, but no. $150,000 and above is only 2% of the population. Now, think about that. Think about how that breaks down. Now, say all of America is 100 people, and all of the tax cuts are $1. If you divide it up the way it's been divided up there, two people will split 60 cents of that, roughly, and the other 98 people split 40 cents. Now, his approach to it, his theory, is the same as Reagan's theory of trickle-down or supply-side economics, or what his dad, before he was Reagan's running mate, when he was actually running against Reagan to be the Republican Party's candidate for president, he referred to Reagan's plan as voodoo economics. And in today's climate of corporate globalization and outsourcing, it really is even dumber than before. Because his theory is you give the rich people more tax breaks and they'll stimulate the economy by building factories and stuff. Now, okay, suppose that were true, which we've seen overwhelmingly isn't. Because overwhelmingly, when given these huge tax breaks, the wealthy tend to just reinvest it or throw it into savings for their kids. That's another thing, too. It's recently come out that 16 wealthy families in the U.S. worth billions of dollars have been exclusively the ones behind the lobbying to get rid of the estate tax. And the line that they try to use, the talking point they try to use to sell that, is saying that the estate tax causes family farms to go under because, you know, they have the inheritance. And some newspaper writers wanted to do a human interest story on farmers that had lost their family farms because of that. So they asked the National Farm Bureau how many had lost their, you know, farms because of the estate tax, and the Farm Bureau said, well, we haven't found any. And that's because when the estate tax was put into place, there was a minimum value on it, meaning the estate had to be worth a certain amount of money before it was taxable. And that limit was set high enough that family farms were not touched. It was an effort to keep families from accumulating a dynastic wealth that could threaten political power by being able to buy legislators, basically, or just, you know, being able to buy access through lobbyists. And so that was, you know, one of the things that was put in place to keep people from becoming so wealthy that they threatened the democracy of the rest of us. And so we see now that, you know, these same people are getting these tax breaks, and what does it do for them? Supposedly, according to the voodoo economics types, the supply-siders, what happens is you give the wealthy tax breaks, and they use that money to build factories and hire people and make goods. Except that they don't. Because they don't build a factory when they see that there is nobody clamoring for that certain commodity that factory will make. And if the middle class doesn't have money in their pockets to buy those commodities, they're not going to be asking for them. So it's not going to make any sense to build a factory for something people can't afford to buy. So what happens is you give these tax breaks to these wealthy people, and if they do build a factory, now in the new globalization age, they're going to build it in Thailand or Indonesia or China, where they can pay the laborers 40 cents an hour. Instead of building it in the U.S., where they have to pay at least $5.15 an hour, federal-wise. Some states have a higher minimum wage. Oregon, my home state, does, for example, but I don't remember what it is. I haven't been there in years, unfortunately. I don't want to get home there, but I digress, of course. The biggest problem now, though, is that these guys don't seem to realize, or you know what, actually, yeah, they do realize. You can't not realize that. They realize, and they don't care, because they don't believe in government. They believe pretty much that government exists to keep the people in line and to keep them from interfering with the corporate process. So these are the kind of people, you know, I mean, I've heard it said so many times, how can you trust somebody to govern if they don't believe in government? And that's the crowd that you, just over half of America, you 51% of America, have put into power. And so we see the results of that. See millions of jobs lost, and the only jobs that are replacing them are paying $9,000 a year less on average than the jobs they replaced. We see 40 million more Americans without health care, without health insurance, that have to go to the emergency room for basic care, when just preventative care could have saved so much more money by eliminating the need to go to the emergency room. We see enough money spent over here so far to have insured 70 million Americans. It's ridiculous. We have people in government who are actively seeking to bankrupt the U.S. so they can sell off the services that we, the people, get from our government, because we put people in place, put our elected representatives in to give us those programs, and they want to sell it off because the corporations can make profits off of it. When they try to tell you that corporations can do it more efficiently, they can do it more cheaply than government can, it's a load of crap. Okay, it's a load of crap. The Federal Employees Health Benefit System, or healthcare system, whichever it's called, but anyway, the healthcare plan that Congress uses, its average overhead is, I think it's between 3 and 5%. It's under 10%. The average overhead for a private HMO is somewhere between 17 and 24%, depending on the HMO. And so you see that in that case, for example, government's doing it more efficiently. Government's doing it more cheaply. And then when you factor in the fact, you know, when you factor in that it's a private company, so it's out to make a profit, you realize that they're not going to be spending money on prevention. They're not willing to, because prevention of disease and prevention of health problems will prevent them from getting bigger profits. If they put money into cancer research and prevention, they might wipe out cancer. Unfortunately for them, because a cancer diagnosis means about $250,000 to the healthcare industry. You get cancer, they make money. So therefore, they have no real incentive to keep you from getting cancer. I'm going to go ahead and take a break because I've got work to do out on this aircraft. See if they've got something out of the way that they were supposed to remove so I can get in and do my part of the repair. Hey everybody, if you want to sound off on something you've heard here on the show, or anything at all really, there are three ways you can go about it. You can email me at watchitburn, one word, at godlesskinzer, KINSER.com, or you can fax me at 1-206-888-2687. Or if you want your voice to be heard, you can call my toll-free number at 1-888-827-3865. That's 1-888-82-REVOLT. Just give me your first name and city and tell me what's on your mind. Please try to keep the phone messages brief, as it can be kind of expensive for me. I look forward to hearing from you.
Gus, this is YB Normal. John, keep up the good work, man. Take care, buddy. Bye.
Hi, Godless. This is Krista P. from the Martin Aaron blog. I was wondering, I've got all the morning sedition shows on disc. And I could make you guys up a disc or two of the morning sedition shows. I'll try to go through and pick out some good ones, but I don't have them all labeled, so it'll be a guess. I'll have to go for Aaron. So let me know on the blog, or you can email me. Good luck, and stay alive out there. Bye.
Thanks for listening, everybody. If you liked what you heard and you feel like supporting this program, go ahead and go on over to my website, godlesskinzer.com, K-I-N-S-E-R. And on the right sidebar there, you'll see an Amazon Honor System pay box. Go ahead and click on there and make a donation. I appreciate all the feedback and support I've been getting from all of y'all. Until next time, take care of yourselves.